Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm just going to make a very brief introduction so that we can move on. I'm really excited to have Marianne here and really looking forward to the talk. As many of you know, Maynooth University's commemoration program for the centenary year of 2016 has focused in part on women and the decade of commemorations from an all-island perspective. This focus, which was conceived of as a corrective to various programs of events running throughout the country, has seen the university host a series of events that has privileged not only a consideration of women's roles in events and culture of a century ago, but also scholarship by women in the present. As we near the end of this centenary year, it is also important that we shift our perspective outside of Ireland, since there are particularly valuable lessons to be learned by considering memory transnationally. This event, which has been generously funded by the Irish Research Council in support of the project of women and the decade of commemorations, sees us host one of the foremost memory studies scholars. Marianne Hirsch is William Peterfield Trent Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University and Director of the Institute for Research on Women, Gender, and Sexuality. Her books, which would be familiar to many of you in the room, include The Generation of Post-Memory, Writing and Visual Culture After the Holocaust, Ghosts of Home, co-authored with Leo Spitzer, Rites of Return, Diaspora, Poetics, and the Politics of Memory, co-edited with Nancy Miller, and Family Frames, Photography, Narrative, and Post-Memory. Professor Hirsch has been the recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Humanities Center, and the American Council of Learned Societies, among others, and is past president of the MLA. Professor Hirsch's work, which has been at the forefront of memory studies, has been significant in its integration of feminist theory and photography, and it is not an exaggeration, but simply a statement of fact to say that her work has had a profound impact on the theorization of memory's transmission, and particularly memory of trauma and violence. It is an immense privilege to welcome Professor Hirsch to here to Maynooth University today. And on behalf of the University, the Department of English, and also the Irish Memory Studies Network, I would ask you to extend a warm welcome to Marianne today as she speaks about small acts mobilizing memory across borders.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. It's been already wonderful to be here in Dublin for the last few days and to follow what's been happening in terms of commemoration of 1916 and the very elaborate memory practices that I've been able to observe in just a few days. Can you hear me? Do we need to project my voice more? Okay, great. So everything that I've encountered here has confirmed something that I've been feeling for the last few years, which is that we're in an era of monumental memory, and monumental memory that supports nationalist and ethnocentric imaginaries. I've been following for the last few years these impressive commemorations, centenaries, and other kinds of commemorations that have marked momentous anniversaries of the beginning of the First World War. This is an image from London. The end of the Second World War, the liberation of Paris. I don't have slides for all of these, the fall of the Berlin Wall, commemoration of the Rwandan and the Armenian genocide, and of course, Ireland is now marking the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising, and as you're finishing this year, but as I've been hearing just in the last few minutes, commemorations will keep occurring because there are many more things ahead in the next few years. What I'm seeing is that these punctual commemorations are occurring in tandem with the opening of new monuments and memorial museums across the globe, from sites like the September 11th Memorial Museum in New York. I just have a couple of images here, and you see how absolutely grand it is, to the recently opened Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw. Just last month, the opening of the National African American Museum in Washington, long overdue, but equally monumental. I have not yet visited it, and I'm really looking forward to it. And then other kinds of memorials in many different places that I've had the occasion to visit. For example, this quite alarming memorial to the victims of the German occupation in Budapest, where you can see Hungary being the innocent angel Gabriel to the German vulture invading it. And of course, many counter-memorials, informal counter-memorials just across the way, protesting this particular, really the denial of Hungary's complicity in the war and in the Holocaust. These are just a few, and really new museums are being planned, especially a number of new Holocaust museums are being planned in Rome, in Amsterdam, in Santiago. And of course, I've also had the occasion to visit in Dublin some of the new installations in the Kilmainham Jail and the GPO. So I think that it's all of a piece, and it's really quite global as a venture. But, you know, of course, at the very same time as we're seeing these memorial structures go up, we're also seeing shocking displays of nationalist and ethnic violence that no doubt are creating new occasions for massive mourning and for future acts of commemoration. And sadly, I don't think there's a contradiction here, because with some notable exceptions, the rituals, the memorials, the museums recalling historical catastrophes across the globe directly or indirectly serve the political interests of present-day regimes that are trying to consolidate their power. Whether they're celebrating moments of patriotism or using the occasion for a national reckoning, these memory rituals and these memorial structures consolidate rather than contest the ethnic and national barriers that are responsible for the violent histories that they're commemorating. I've been concerned about this reification of and monumentalization of memory in the last few years, and I've been trying to think of ways that this renewed monumentality and the nationalist imaginaries that it supports can be contested, are being contested. So I've been thinking about strategies by which the archives of painful past can be mobilized for a more progressive future. I've been thinking that in the 1990s, when the field of memory studies was really being built or by a number of people in scholars, these scholars have been inspired by critical public memory practices. And I'm showing you a couple of them here. You no doubt know about the Stolpersteine, the stumbling stones that were first being installed in Germany, but also now all over East and Central Europe to mark the names of Jews and others who were persecuted by the Nazis. As another example, in the Bavarian Quarter in Berlin, these street signs that that inscribe Nazi racial laws with images on the other side. So very small, informal structures. These are just some examples of the kind of counter-monuments, counter-memorials, critical memory practices, not just in Europe, but also in South America and South Africa and other parts of the world, that are small urban interventions that are powerful and that inspired, I think, the field of memory studies in the academy. But I think what's happened today is that these counter-memory practices are fewer, they're more informal, they're less well-funded, and they're primarily reactive rather than proactive, as in the case of the small informal counter-memorials that I showed you in Budapest. These are just individual and group strategies rather than more negotiated, sort of publicly negotiated ones, as here, where the artists actually had to negotiate with the municipality to install these signs that have now been up for a couple of decades. In contrast to this, what I see is that memory studies has continued to cross and to challenge nationalism, ethnocentrism, and identity politics in the interests of a more inclusive, a more connective, a more comparative kind of imaginary and future. It's conceived memory as transnational and transcultural, showing that cultures and nations themselves are not static or clearly circumscribed, but in constant active contact with others. It's a flaw to think of a nation or a culture as a container of memory. Instead, memory studies scholars have suggested we should look at mnemonic itineraries at travel and traffic, at mobility, at connectivity. So, for example, I'm showing you here a memorial from Buenos Aires. I don't know how many people have been to Buenos Aires to see this memorial by the artist Marcelo Brodsky in the Recoleta Cultural Center, and you see reflected in the mirror the identical memorial that it's inspired by, which is in Berlin in front of one of the railway stations that inscribes the names of all the concentrations and death camps in Germany. And so what's happened in Buenos Aires is that they used the identical memorial to inscribe the names of all the torture centers during the dictatorship. So these are the kinds of transnational connections that it doesn't necessarily mean that these are equivalent acts of violence, but that memory cultures can be inspired by one another. So looking at current memorial and archival practices, it seems to me might inspire us to build on this critical edge. And I've been thinking about which memorial and archival practices might continue the critical edge that some of these memorials had earlier. What kind of practices might let us think of violent histories in relation to each other rather than separately and competitively as the exclusionary property of a single identity-based group? How might we mobilize the archives not only of violence and catastrophe, but of resistance, of protest, of hope for the future in order to move forward toward a future that recalls past crimes without appropriating them, without being paralyzed by them, without succumbing to nationalist or ethnocentric ideologies that would perpetuate a political culture of fear and denial? So in thinking and speaking about this, I must say that I've been most inspired by some memory networks and groups that I've joined and had the privilege to be part of, and I'm very happy to be sponsored here by the Irish Memory Network that also is doing an all-island kind of thinking about an all-island memory practice. And I think that these kinds of connections are probably the most inspiring and helpful. So I've had the privilege to be part of a number of different memory networks, but one in particular that's taught me a great deal, and that is a three-year project called Women Mobilizing Memory that we started at Columbia with some of the university's global centers and colleagues from Santiago, Chile, and Istanbul, Turkey. And together, we've had a kind of mobile meetings in these three different sites. It's a network of scholars, artists, and activists, and I think those kinds of interdisciplinary and scholars of, you know, and journalists, many different disciplines. I think the conversations that we've been able to have, the visits that we've paid together to memory sites in these three different cities, the art exhibits that we've had the opportunity to curate, the performances that have been produced in relation to our work, these discussions of the aftermath of violence have been very inspiring in trying to think about different forms of protest and resistance. And I think that what these mobile transnational meetings have led me to think about is about mobility itself and what it might mean to mobilize memory, but also to mobilize memory for progressive and political ends, which is not always necessarily the case. What it means to reclaim memories of hope, of revolution, rather than merely memories of violence, catastrophe, and trauma. Judith Butler has recently argued that our mobility as social subjects depends on support and material conditions, she said, on architecture and infrastructure. I think we're thinking about that a lot these days with the refugee crisis that we're all witnessing across the globe, really. And of course, in the aftermath of genocide, war, of political repression, of massive individual and communal losses, these conditions, this kind of infrastructure and support structure is necessarily compromised. And that might in itself create the need for large compensatory gestures like these enormous museums and memory practices that I've showed you. So I'm thinking of what the alternatives might be. And using a feminist critical lens, I focused instead on aesthetic acts that I think activate small, unofficial, non-hegemonic collections and archives that mobilize alternative feminist circuits of memory and connectivity. And I love this image of drowned monuments by the artist Cornelia Parker. I think that these aesthetic practices, these small acts, can also be used in large memorial institutions. And I've tried to look at some of these new museums to see how some of them, in fact, do use these, counteracting the monumental strategies that they might be supporting. But in particular, the memory acts that I found most inspiring have been from diasporic communities, acts that mobilize personal and cultural loss, envisioning potential alternative historical trajectories. So I've looked at the work of a number of different artists, women artists. I will speak a little bit later about this wonderful project by Yin Zhu Zhen called Portable Cities. But Mieke Bal, the cultural critic Mieke Bal, has said that art, she's written a lot about migratory culture, and she says art, and I quote, can enact small-scale resistances against the status quo in the social domain. These acts, which we call little resistances, determine the limited yet potentially powerful political impact of art. And that's really how I want to look at some of these artists that that I want to discuss with you. Similarly, Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick has described what she calls the middle ranges of agency that act as alternatives to grand reactive gestures and offer space, she says, for effectual creativity and change. So thinking about some of these small works as part of the middle ranges of agency rather than the grand reactive gestures that we see in the museums and memorials that we've seen. Contemporary artists have used a variety of media to devise anti-monumental migratory practices that might affect such little resistances. And what is it important to resist? It seems to me that it's important to resist the nationalist and ethnocentric idioms and their monumentalization and reification of memory. It's important to resist an easy forms of consumption and empathy with what Susan Sontag has called the pain of others. I think it's important to resist repeating or reinscribing the structures that are responsible for violence and oppression, the violence and oppression that's being recalled. And it's also important to resist activating feelings of vulnerability in the interests of nationalist protection and denial. And I will also speak about this work in a little while. Well, to me, vulnerability has been a key aspect of the kinds of extraterritorial memory aesthetics that I'd like to discuss with you and define with you here today. It's not a vulnerability that's manufactured to provoke fear or disavowal, as vulnerability politically often has been. Instead, feminists have defined vulnerability as a space of interconnection in the face of entangled histories. And I found vulnerability to be, in fact, more enabling than trauma in thinking about violent histories and their afterlives in the present. And when I was president of the MLA, I mean, one of the nice things about being president is that you can name a theme for the convention. And my theme was vulnerable times. And I had the occasion there to think about vulnerability and what it can offer us as a way, as an alternative to trauma, not denying trauma and traumatization of in the violent histories that I have been thinking about and discussing, but in opening it up to thinking a more open and future-oriented way of thinking about the aftermath of these violent histories. So I find that trauma is very much backward-looking and conceives of a violent or a painful past as being repeated endlessly into the future, always destroying the world of the present and the future, whereas vulnerability might be a way of thinking forward as a form of openness. I think that as an embodied species, of course, we share a common vulnerability that emerges from the condition of living in our bodies and of living in time. But importantly, vulnerability is also socially, politically, and economically created. And it's differentially imposed on different populations, and it, of course, it can be mobilized for divergent political aims. An acknowledgement of vulnerability, both shared and produced, can open a space of interconnection as well as a platform of responsiveness for the little resistances, which I've tried to discuss. So I think if we think of vulnerability as an openness toward surprising possibilities, we might be able to engage it more creatively as a space to work from and not as something that needs to be overcome. And it seems to me that thinking about vulnerability in that way could inspire an ethics and a politics of open-endedness and mobility, attuning us to the needs of the past in the present, as well as to the urgency for change in the future. And when I was thinking about vulnerability in my role as responsible for the Modern Language Association, I was thinking of vulnerability as a condition that makes us open to, producers and consumers of works of art, right? Art practices and aesthetic encounters, I want to suggest, foster a kind of receptive responsiveness that's based on vulnerability. Unless we make ourselves vulnerable to the works that we read or look at or listen to or perform or watch, we cannot really encounter them. We need to practice openness. We need to practice interconnection, imagination, as we acknowledge our own implication in these works. And aesthetic works, whether they're visual, whether they're literary, whether they're acoustic or performatic, enable us to reflect on the vulnerabilities that they elicit within us and the attuned responsiveness that they enable us to practice. Aesthetic works, whether and aesthetic works also, for me, have helped me think through some of these issues about how memory is practiced and can be practiced. They can serve, as the art historian Hubert Damisch has said, as theoretical objects, as objects that help us think. And he writes that a theoretical object obliges you to do theory, but also furnishes you with the means of doing it. And for me, these aesthetic works have helped me think about the vulnerabilities that they elicit within us, but also the responsiveness that they enable us to practice. So this by way of introduction to a number of works, and I think it will all hopefully become clearer as we think together about some memorial artworks and installations that can mobilize ordinary archives to create vulnerable and mobile memory practices that, to me, offer an alternative to the monumental structures that I began with, and practices that enable us to re-envision the past in a way that looks to its own future, but also, therefore, to our own future. So I just want to begin with this work, and with actually two artists, Mirta Kupfer-Mink and Silvina Dermerger-Dichan. They're two women artists who coincidentally were both born and raised in Argentina, one as the daughter of Holocaust survivors and the second as the granddaughter of survivors of the Armenian Genocide. I think that both of their work forges a diasporic aesthetic that allow us to think further about mobilizing memories to forge connective and transformative histories of painful pasts. So let me just begin with this work that I've already shown you a couple of times. This is an etching from 2001 by Mirta Kupfer-Mink, who, as I said, is the daughter of Auschwitz survivors, raised in and working in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And I think this is the perfect work to think about mobility with and think about memory with, because it shows us both the dangers and potentialities inherent in diasporic memory practices. So what we have here, it seems to me, are seven figures who attempt to move forward from left to right, but they're immobilized, they're pulled backward, they're hunched over under the weight of the objects they carry. Not just uprooted trees, but houses, household objects, windmills, entire villages. And this is even more dramatic in the vertical triptych version of the work, in which the trees cover the top two panels, dwarfing the human figures under their shadow. What's more, these figures seem to float on different planes. There's no solid ground under their feet. And though their momentum points forward, they're slowed by the weight of memory and of the past, a burden that they can't seem to shed. They certainly lack the material support that might safely enable a freely chosen mobility. These figures are probably the victims of expulsion. They're probably refugees like the ones that we've been seeing on the news every day. In Mirta Kupferming's iconography of Jewish exile, uprooted trees signify removal from home and a violent break in continuity, in genealogy, in generation. In absorbing nourishment from the soil, trees contain the knowledge of the past and they carry it into the future, but if uprooted for too long, they will die, obliterating generations of history and of memory. So in the etching, and in especially in an animated version from 2005. I wanted to show you a little bit of this. It'll come up in a second. It's a 9-minute animated version of En Camino, of this image. And I can't show you the 9 minutes, but you'll see a little bit of it here. So in the etching, in the video especially, humans blend into trees. They become themselves embodied archives of a past knowledge that they can attempt with difficulty to carry forward. What the animation does that's different from the etching is that it enables their motion without diminishing the weighty burden of memory that they continue to carry. So there's a lot more mobility, of course, in the animation. Here, the figures are still carrying suitcases, they carry bags, they carry trees. They walk, they run, they climb, they float. They're blown around on multiple non-intersecting planes. They move forward, they move backward, they move sideways. Some of them morph into hybrid mythical creatures. You'll see this in a moment. They metamorphose into Hebrew letters. They float into and out of books and pages. They walk up and down a ruler. They emerge from coat pockets. Hebrew letters multiply in this animation. Torahs move forward and backward. A king, you'll see him in a minute, sits in a boat hovering precariously on top of the Tower of Babel. So while the etching evokes memory as an overwhelming burden, it seems to me that the video is animated by a very different kind of affect. There's a kind of surreal humor here, there's incongruity. There's a playfulness that lightens without diminishing the burden of a painful past. These characters seem trapped in the pages and the repeated gestures of an ancient Jewish scenario of expulsion and exile, a story that's being written about, for, but also that's being written against them. The cyclical movement and the ending of the video, which is cyclical, and you can watch it on Vimeo if you'd like, implies the perpetual repetition of this scenario. But it seems to me that as these letters float around on the screen as though the playful doodles of a child, we're also invited to imagine different scenarios with different beginnings and endings. And this is what I wanted to highlight here, that this need not be a story of a repetition of traumatic expulsion and exile in which your past home will weigh you down so that you cannot move forward. I think something else is going on here. I think that the artist grants her characters the shape of letters that can be arranged and rearranged, that she can then mobilize multiple potential histories on the threshold of perhaps a more open-ended future. These recursive trajectories complicate a genealogical temporality of loss and attempted recovery and loss again. I think it's an evocative aesthetics of small gestures in miniature with humor. And its circuits of mythic memory bypass homogeneous national traditions and heteronormative genealogies in favor of diasporic networks that could be reimagined and that could be reconfigured. But even in this movement, they remain anchored in a Jewish story of disaster and loss that continues to slow and to haunt them. And Camino is the work of an artist whose images address both recent and ancient Jewish history and philosophy. Kupfer Mink is a student of Kabbalah. She's a reader of Borges and of Hannah Arendt. She's an artist who experiments with many innovative media. And I'll move on from the video now with regret, just to show you a little bit more of her work. Some of her work draws specifically on women's artisanal practices such as sewing, fabric, embroidery, and she uses these to inscribe memory on the very surface of the skin. And yet, I think that her migratory aesthetic doesn't envision recuperation or return. On the contrary, the spaces and wounds of expulsion and of exile are carried on the artist's body and on the skin, but even though they were transmitted to her viscerally, as we see here, she's able to find a way to move forward and to imagine different futures without forgetting or evacuating the difficult past that pervades her work. And I think what's interesting here is that even though we give there's a kind of shrug in seeing the needle that pierces her skin, it seems to me that it's offset by the simplicity of the embroidery design. It's the kind of thing that all of us as young girls would learn from our mothers or grandmothers. So I think that it offsets the pain of the incision on the skin of her hand. So I'd love to talk more about your reading of some of this work and to see if in any way it corresponds to mine and what you see in it. But I'm going to move on to Silvina Demirgerica now to talk a little bit about her work and practice. She also uses hybrid archival media to recall a catastrophe that occurred long before she was born in a diasporic community in Argentina and to reconstruct the lives that were destroyed. Demirgerica currently lives and works in Berlin, though she was raised in Argentina, as the granddaughter of refugee survivors of the Armenian Genocide. And it seems to me that she encounters a somewhat different problem than the second generation artist Mirta Kupfer-Mink, because third generation memory of destruction that hasn't been acknowledged, politically acknowledged, is multiply mediated and attenuated by inherited stories and objects, whether personal, familial, and intimate, or public and collective. It's composed of shadows and traces. And certainly after three generations of denial, Armenian memory can often be mobilized in the interest of reconstruction and restitution. Its memory, mobility, it's tethered by nostalgia. It's no wonder that diasporic Armenian artists exhibit what the cultural critic Marie-Aude Baronian describes as an archival desire that would be able to make a phantom past newly visible and palpable. And Demirgerica is certainly an archival artist, as you can see here. But at the same time, what I think distinguishes her is that she rejects identitarian politics and aesthetics. She rejects ethno-nationalism and its monumentality. So I'm going to show you a couple of her works. The first is this quite elaborate carpet series that she has created and exhibited, and in an exhibit on the transmission of memory across generation, quite a multicultural exhibit that's opening in San Francisco, I think, this next month. Her carpet series will be shown along with the work of artists from many different other sites. It's a series of crocheted collages that embed archival studio photographs, stamps, and ID cards onto tapestries, quilts, carpets, and maps. These are objects that I think anyone would try to take along into exile, objects that not only evoke the past, but that were literally touched by those who were murdered and by those who survived. The images are blown up. They're printed on paper and laminated and crocheted together with colored yarn, linking pre-genocide family portraits, wedding photos, individual pictures, group pictures to one another. The artist creates carpets that are then hung on walls or suspended in the gallery so that visitors can walk around them and also see themselves reflected in them from both sides when light is projected onto the images and making the surfaces translucent. These carpets are light. They can be folded and packed up. They consist of objects that refugees and migrants bring along, precious objects such as photos and ID cards, but also quite ordinary objects from everyday life. In placing some of these installations into the urban spaces in Turkey that were violently emptied of Armenian presence, Demir Gerdichan doesn't try to reclaim those spaces, but she connects them with others on a crocheted map. In some recent installations, she projects videos onto these carpets. I think I showed you an image like that before. And the video underscores the transmission of bodily memory of practice because it's a video of women learning how to crochet together in the artist's studio. So she's trying to also to teach and reclaim some of these memories. And again, the stitches are simple. They're, the kind of things that little girls can do. I think that what this series does is to underscore the texture and affect of memory and thereby inviting touch and opening a space where we might allow ourselves to be touched in return. Related to this is another project of hers called Red Thread. And here the texture of memory is reduced to just to a thread evoking, of course, a thread of red wool, which evokes the blood of genocidal murder. But that's not how the artist sees these. What she says is that by being transmitted across generation, Armenian stories have lost the red thread that would tie them together. So what she wants to offer the visitor is this thread through which people can then create and recreate their own memories while preserving the break. She gives us a thread with which she can offer potential stories, the mere textures of disappearance, without actually spinning out these stories herself. So these are the threads of open-ended potential histories yet to be written about the Armenian genocide, and histories in which cycles of violence might perhaps be interrupted, in which teleologies leading to disaster might be redirected. So I want to finish my discussion of her work with a very recent installation that she did as part of the Venice Biennale of 2015, in which, as you might know, the Armenity Pavilion won the prize for the best pavilion, and she was part of this this pavilion. The curators of the Biennale saw this as a specifically anti-national or nationalist project, because they called it Armenity, and there were actually no artists from the Republic of Armenia represented, but there were a number of diaspora, I think 13 artists from the Armenian diaspora, and the curators wrote, "The curatorial concept of Armenity implies the notion of displacement and territory, justice and reconciliation, ethos and resilience. Regardless of their place of birth, the selected artists carry within them the identity and the memory of their origins. They are all grandchildren, in that sense, who are concerned," they write, "for memory, justice, and reconciliation that skillfully transcends notions of territory, borders, and geography." So this installation was installed on a very meaningful site for Armenian history in Venice. It's it's the island of San Lazaro, which is off the coast of the city of Venice, which houses a monastery that was established in 1717 by an Armenian monk to archive a cultural heritage and to offer a haven for Armenian culture in Europe. And the island contains a library and a number of objects that were brought, that were collected there to memorialize Armenian culture, but also to build a kind of treasure chest for Armenians in Europe. And it's in these beautiful cases on the island that contain glass bottles, Etruscan figures, Chinese teacups, many, many different kinds of Wunderkammer objects that Silvina Demir Gerichan installed her own installation called Treasures. And this installation builds on a really remarkable object that she inherited from her great-grandmother, a handwritten notebook of 350 folk health remedies written in Armenian script in the Turkish language. So the great-grandmother, a genocide survivor who immigrated to Argentina with her daughter, who was Silvina's grandmother, wrote the book in Cordoba, Argentina in 1943. So it's pretty amazing. She writes it in 1943 in Armenian script in Turkish, and she's attempting to hand down these 350 folk remedies. So the installation consists of this notebook and a number of other objects that the artist has collected. Ingredients for these recipes that she's trying to reconstruct, Anatolian plants, small sacks full of seeds and other healing substances, as well as the chemical formulas by which they might be assembled and do the work of healing. And there are also photographs of her great-grandmother, and the family is there. And I think what she is trying to do is trying to inscribe her great-grandmother into a history of Armenian healers, most of whom were obviously men, putting her back into a history of tradition of healers from Cilicia. It's not coincidental that among the recipes, Silvina Demir Gerdichan chose several remedies that were remedies for maladies of the eye. The first 60, she writes, are for maladies of the eye. For example, for eyes that look but don't see, for teary eyes. And of here she also made a video that I wanted to show you that also shows her effort to learn, to try to imagine and learn the practice of making some of these remedies rather than reading about them, reading the recipe book. I was very struck by this idea that there were 60 recipes for remedies of the eye, and I was wondering what the great-grandmother wanted to transmit. Obviously, by writing this notebook, she had a future in mind. She wanted to hand something down. She was no doubt eager to pass on a wealth of traditional knowledge she had acquired and brought with her into exile to transmit healing practices that had been passed down to her, to transmit them viscerally and bodily. But including 60 recipes for eye ailments, she might also have wanted her descendants to see something that they weren't seeing as they look back to the past and forward into the future. And I've been wondering what that might be and what she might have had in mind. It seems to me that building the installation around the notebooks, the great-granddaughter artist does more than to pay tribute to her great-grandmother's learning. She responds to this call, I think, to see better, to receive the fantasies of healing sent to her across time and space, to transport it across the seas to encounter other stories and other histories in an expanded extraterritorial archive. We might not be able to make remedies from these recipes, but the artist has given us a blueprint, a set of ingredients, and a set of bodily practices, not only for healing and repair, but also, it seems to me, for a critical engagement with memory practices that instrumentalize the past for the benefit of a political present. And I think that in these installations, you can see the kind of vulnerability that she's practicing in responding to this call from the great-grandmother, and also in responding to the objects that she has collected and inherited, such as the photographs in the carpet series. So I just want to end Well, this is one more image from the Armenity exhibit. Well, I want to end by coming back to this other project, Portable Cities, and in exploring how it might be related. I was very attracted to it, of course, because it was small. But at the same time, it seems to me that it might be strange to discuss it here because it doesn't respond to a specific history of trauma and destruction as the other two. But it does seem to me to illustrate both the promises of memory's mobility and the difficulties of mobilizing memory for change, and that it does so in a different way. So this is a project by the Chinese artist Yin Zhuzhen, which was begun in 2001 and which is ongoing. Wherever she goes, she makes a suitcase city to bring along. She builds cityscapes in open suitcases, toy-like miniature buildings that are made out of fabrics, buttons, and other objects that she collects from people living in the particular sites where she produces the cities. Then she displays these in the site itself. She has New York, Beijing, Melbourne, Tokyo, Düsseldorf, but many and many Chinese cities that she has already made. To supplement the viewer's visual and tactile engagement with the work, each suitcase also contains a soundscape recorded in the city's public spaces, and each suitcase has a small hole that invites us to look through a magnifying glass at a map of the city displayed on the level below. The earliest inspiration for my suitcase work, Yin Zhuzhen writes, came from the baggage lines at the airport. As she traveled for her exhibits and watched the suitcases roll by, she, quote, thought each one was like a tiny shrunken home. It's a witty response to the travails of globalization and the resulting homogenization of urban landscapes that shrinks difference and reduces urban spaces to recognizable landmarks. And nevertheless, I think that these portable cities carry the artist's personal feelings about each site. At the same time, they also become sites of collective memory as they are made out of the fabrics that are collected from people who live in these places. Yin writes that, she says, "I believe that clothing is people's second skin." And as she sews these experiences of people together by means of their old clothes, transforming them into miniature buildings, bridges, parks, and squares, she magically believes that she's creating a collective unconscious. The art historian Philippe Verne writes that in Yin's work, memory becomes a critical tool. And we might want to think about how that is. I'm not convinced. The Portable Cities and her other work, which is based in recycled materials, counters the disposal of traditional lifeways and the constant renewal, traffic, and exchange characterizing the era of globalization. Airports, public restrooms are the spaces she uses as sites of intervention, and she reconfigures the hard technologies of globalization, making weapons, television towers, airplanes, engines, cars, buses, with the softness of cotton, of wool, and of silk. So it's definitely an art of resistance. It's of small-scale resistance and memorialization, in which she reshapes objects from the past and endows them with new life, with new meaning, enabling them to carry multiple unprocessed memories into a future that obviously races ahead and which she can't stop. In the gallery, the cities Yin has built, rebuilt in miniature form, are connected by blue threads on a large map mounted on the wall, forming a network of contact and interconnection, a network that's in constant flux as new nodal points appear along its routes as she makes more suitcase cities. Though portable, the cities are nevertheless fixed onto this large map. Even in their mobility, they remain pinned to the wall. Rather than locating memory on site, the portable cities allow sites and monuments of memory to travel, activating recall wherever they go, and thus activating networks of transnational and global connectivity as well. This is an aesthetics of vulnerability, it seems to me, that miniaturizes the details of everyday life to enable us at once to experience them on a small scale and to gain some ironic distance from their eventfulness and monumentality, from the losses and transformations that shape them. Cities are spaces of transformation and renewal par excellence, and they're also the sites of memory and commemoration. In Yin's work, even megacities become small, manageable, and portable. If we contrast the suitcase cities to the burdensome suitcases that Mirta Kupfer-Ming's characters carry in her En Camino, it's obviously quite a contrast. In sitting on the floor of the gallery or the museum, housing miniature buildings and sites, Yin's cities seem light and compact. Bodily traces survive in the small stitches that construct the miniature structures and in the containers of other people's possessions transported across borders along routes of the displacement and renewal. But they don't weigh us down, as Kupfer-Ming's do. They merely serve to show a natural and a manufactured process of oblivion as time marches on. As their contents can be repurposed, recycled, discarded, these memories lack the heaviness of traumatic expulsion. But do they not also lack the import of individual and local histories, however weighty? Mobility seems to be performed here lightly, inconsequentially, for its own sake. And yet, I think in galvanizing a movement forward that recalls individual and collective hopes and disappointments without being unduly encumbered by them, it serves as an ironic foil to monumentality, inspiring other acts and objects of small-scale resistance. Memorial museums, especially if they're built on sites of memory or of destruction, take up space calling attention to loss and attempting to recuperate it. They monumentalize memory to claim or reclaim hegemonic official national narratives in the present, and thus they attempt to fix the evanescence of memory and the disappearance of the past. The deterritorialized memorial practices that I've highlighted and discussed here this afternoon also engage in acts of repair, but these are small acts that don't, it seems to me, aim at restitution. Rather, they seem to call that possibility into question, whether humorously or seriously. If they rebuild, they take up small, virtual spaces. They acknowledge the haunting imprecisions of memory. They perform its wounds. But at the same time, they enable us to imagine alternative potential histories that can reconfigure painful past. Now, I've talked about the idea of potential history several times, and I just want to say that I've been inspired by the work of political theorist and photography theorist Ariella Azoulay, who has written about potential history and has actually used it as a verb, as the idea of potentializing history. And what she's inspired by Walter Benjamin's idea of an incomplete history, and she sees potential history not just as a sense of what was, but in the sense of what might have been. And the act of encountering history in this way, actively to potentialize it in her terms, is to revisit it so that it yields different, perhaps incongruent, unrealized possibilities, eventualities that resonate across time and space. And it seems to me that to potentialize history is to be vulnerable to its outcomes and in a way that allows it possibly to change course. To potentialize history is to see what was from a different angle, through different eyes. An openness to different potential rather than one single linear history would mean the ability to accommodate conflicting truths that could lead to alternative futures, and thus counterintuitively perhaps to alternate pasts as well. I think that the small gestures of intervention performed by artists such as the ones that I've shown you this afternoon, these small gestures like miniaturization, humor, fantasy, play, the embrace of incongruity and contradiction, enable such an envisioning of alternative of multiple trajectories, of alternative trajectories. And thus it seems to me that these artists resist the monumentality that memory has acquired in our very eventful present, and a monumentality that's been holding us back. And I, for me, the work of these artists has inspired me to think further about how memory might be mobilized for a progressive future. Thank you.